Welcome to the Behaviorist Book Club. We are a community of practitioners focused on helping your clients achieve meaningful and socially significant behavior change. This is your host, Matt Harrington.
Hello and welcome to the Behaviorist Book Club. We are going to be going over geographic access to registered behavior technicians among children with autism spectrum disorder. This is by Marissa Yingling and colleagues and was published in Behavior Analysis and Practice. I don't think this is going to be a super long one, but there's a couple of things that I want to pull out of this article that I think are going to be relevant, at least as a discussion point. It might change a little bit of your perspective if you're somebody who works with or without a behavior technician. Now, throughout this episode, because the authors use it, I'm going to be referring a lot to the different credentials that the Behavior Analysis Certification Board has in their repertoire. So specifically, that is the BCBA, the Board Certified Behavior Analyst, the BCBAD, that's the doctorate designation, and the Registered Behavior Technician, the RBT. All of those phrases and those credentials are all trademarked by the BACB, and I wanted to give them their credit and the trademark legal stuff with that. So let's jump right into it. There are 50,000 behavior analysts, BCBA and BCBAD certificates. Notably, half of those certificates have gotten their credential within the first 5 years. And while this isn't really the focus of the article, every time I see this stat, I think it's worthwhile to talk about. It blows my mind each time how young our field is in terms of supervisory experience. Similar to multiple exemplar training, the longer you're in a field and the longer you're experiencing a client situation, a caregiver meeting, a crisis behavior to a social validity concern over and over again, the more experience you get in dealing with those behaviors. Classrooms and 2,000 hours of supervision simply can't replicate that. I'm really interested to see how some opinions on different challenges and different situations in the clinical world are going to change as our field grows older in terms of supervisory experience. I would expect more nuance. I would expect more discussion about some of these tougher issues because of the fact that we simply have more experience within the field. We know more, so we're probably going to do a little bit differently. Now, with those 50,000 BCBA certificates, there's 100,000 behavior technician, RBT, certificates. Now, an RBT, that's very simple to get. It's 40 hours of training. You have to pass a competency exam, and you have to have a high school diploma as well as a written exam. The RBT provides the bulk of the one-on-one behavior analysis services. The behavior analyst supervising typically at 20, hopefully closer to 30% of those hours, and doing all the programming and caregiver training. It's important to consider what the accessibility of RBTs looks like for our field, and it's important for two main reasons. The first one is that if RBTs are providing the bulk of services, that means many of our evidence-based practices depend on a larger amount of time than 1 to 2 hours a week. They depend on 5-10 hours a week. So if an RBT isn't present to provide those services for that time frame, things are probably going to have to be modified to adjust back to solid behavior analysis that is evidence-based. So without an RBT accessible, that totally changes what your practice is going to look like, which brings me to the second point. Because we have so many behavior technicians who eventually become behavior analysts, I know that's what happened to me, then we have to realize that our now supervisors have grown up only providing services with an RBT next to them. They've never had the chance to do anything independently as a supervisor. This means if they have the opportunity to then be an independent behaviorist, they're probably not going to have the skill set. It's different. You look at some of the behavior analysts who don't use an RBT and only bill direct with the client themselves. Everything looks different about their practice because they've had to change the way they do it to maintain solid evidence-based practice. Accessibility matters, not only for the fact that we need to continue our supervision and training module with evidence-based practices, but also we need to consider what happens if behavior technicians are not accessible. So this article is really looking to gather data on three different variables. What is, at a county level, the RBT presence, the RBT and BCBA presence, and the presence of ASD? Now, they're going to be chatting about how we need to look at the ratio between RBTs and ASD prevalence. To be completely honest, I don't know if that's super relevant variable because I don't think that every person with ASD needs a behavior technician right there on deck. And of course, the authors aren't saying this explicitly, but I think when you have that type of statistic, it leads to that type of conclusion. So let me say it for you then. We don't, like, every person with autism does not need a behavior technician. They don't need ABA services. Some do, but it's not like it's a, oh, hey, you have autism, here's a behavior technician, you need ABA. Quick pause here for a second so I can tell you about something that's going to benefit you massively. You can probably tell that I read a lot of research just to produce this podcast and also just to keep my head above water in my clinical work. See, I'm always looking for the most efficient, quickest, and most practitioner yet also evidence-based way to solve the clinical challenges in front of me. However, as you know, quick and research don't always go hand in hand, and that's why I created the Solving Clinical Challenges with Research course to teach you an efficient 20 to 30 minute method to access, utilize, and identify research articles, as well as summarizing them so that you can have the best information possible to solve your clinical challenges. This 2CEU course is completely free for podcast listeners. Just go to behavioristbookclub.com/solving. behavioristbookclub.com/solving to get your free 2CEU course. Back to the podcast. The dispersion for these statistics was about what you'd expect. So we had a lot of activity along the coast and a lot of activity as we stretched in, and then very little behavior analysis in the center of the country. There was also a lot of behavior technicians who marked that they were still practicing ABA services and were keeping up their credential, but there wasn't another behavior analyst within that county. So that could mean a couple of things ranging from very bad to not too bad. The worst could be that they were practicing behavior analysis without a behavior analyst supervisor. That would be the worst case scenario, right? There, an RBT is probably misrepresenting what ABA is and isn't able to practice with a high degree of fidelity because they don't have that training and experience. Other better solutions that hopefully were happening is just that a behavior analyst was providing support via telehealth or just by commuting into the county. Now, before we move on to the what does this mean for us section, it's also important to talk about how the authors described a lack of behavior technician presence as somewhat being a self-repeating cycle, where recruitment of behavior technicians in an area is so tough because there are no behavior technicians in that area. And then if there's no behavior technicians in that area, there's probably not going to be a lot of behavior analysis, which then creates a lack of behavior technicians. Because a behavior technician can't operate independently, they need a behavior analyst. That means a behavior analyst has to be there for some reason, whether it be they just love the area, they grew up there, they moved there, they found ABA organically, whatever could happen, they moved to a location. It's very sparse in ABA, and then they want to open up a practice. They want to serve clients. But if they're used to the behavior technician model of having an RBT providing 10, 15, 20 hours of direct services per client, they're going to need to change their skill set probably at the beginning because they won't have any behavior technicians who are able to serve their clients. And that's the problem. That's the self-repeating cycle. The reality is, if you have to choose as a behavior analyst who wants to use behavior technicians to practice in a place like Florida or California that are the densest locations for behavior technicians, or you have to practice in the middle of the country, it makes more sense to do it where there's more behavior technicians. And this is a business move as much as it is a comfort move. You're surrounded by other people who know about what you're doing versus being isolated. And of course, there's that self-repeating cycle. And it is getting better. The data is showing an increase in accessibility, but most behavior technicians are being trained and built and demonstrated or shown the field by other behavior technicians. So for example, when I worked in the college town, almost all the people who we employed ended up being referrals from current employees. They would go to their classes, they would be working on their master's program or their undergrad in psychology, and they would be employed with us. And then we would say, hey, we're hiring another 2 behavior technicians. If you know of anybody who'd be a good fit, send them on in. And so we'd get college students who are friends and roommates and brothers and sisters, rather than having to recruit just straight from like LinkedIn, simply because that was how the referral system was built. So what I'm trying to point out here is that repeating cycle and the harm that can happen if we don't have really brave behavior analysts who step out and say, no, I am going to provide services in this ABA dry location and start the process of renewing interest in the field in those areas. Now, there's 2 more things that I want to chat about in terms of what this means for us. I want to talk about 2 ways to solve some of the accessibility problems, one being more scalable, but a little bit more or very difficult. And the other one being it takes a little bit more experience, but it's not as scalable, but I think there's a lot of merit to it. I'm of course talking about telehealth and independent behavior analyst work. So let's start with telehealth. I was a telehealth supervisor, completely telehealth, for about 1.5 years to 2 years. So I have a decent amount of experience within this realm. And I think that it's very safe to say that telehealth, in my opinion, is harder than being in person. And I know I commute 30 minutes to my job right now. I have to get dressed and comb my hair and put on work pants, and it's awful. And I'm not trying to minimize the benefits that telehealth has. Getting to drink your fancy coffee at home, getting to roll out of bed at 7:50, chug an energy drink and get into session at 8 o'clock is an absolute win. And it's one of the reasons why I stayed in telehealth so long. Simply in the relationship building with the client and with the family, and even with your technicians, it's very hard to build those relationships, to have that caregiver training, to have a normal caseload when you're telehealth. Because you're very flexible and you're able to do this whenever, and you're able to hop in and hop off your computer so fast, sometimes companies want to load you up with cases. They say, hey, I know you're billing 25 hours, but because you can go from one client to another and there's no drive time and you can do your behavior plans at home after session or at night, you'll probably take more to 30, 35, and then you have more caseloads. And then everything gets compounded because in order to be a good telehealth supervisor, it's a lot of caregiver training. So you have to spend a lot of time one-on-one with that caregiver to build the relationship. The other challenge is that in my experience, it's very hard to build relationships with the learner. With some learners who are more highly verbal and vocal, you can start to have those conversations over a computer screen, but with a lot of early language and younger learners, you're not really going to be a preferred person. You're going to be the weirdo on the computer screen. And so you have to rely on your technician and the technician training that you're doing to make sure that your client's still getting high quality ABA. So it takes longer to build relationships with the client, it takes longer to build relationships with the caregivers, and you spend a lot more time in caregiver training, and you spend a lot of time supporting your technician in technician training. On top of all of that, with all of those extra duties, it's hard for the technician not to feel abandoned when a crisis happens and their telehealth supervisor is 8 hours away. And I think this isn't talked about enough within the telehealth world, is the feeling that a behavior technician has about a telehealth supervisor. The technician is driving across the county, stuck in traffic, having to deal with all of the messiness that sometimes goes on in the clinical or the home setting, and you're sitting at home drinking a nice coffee. Obviously, there's a little bit of probably frustration by the technician, seeing as they're driving across the county and you're just relaxing at home. And it all comes down to relationship building. So is telehealth a super nice, convenient, and solid way to do behavior analysis? Definitely. But it's a lot harder. Now, I'm firmly of the opinion that telehealth done right is just as effective as in-person behavior analysis, but it's harder to do right. And the reason I believe that is because if I didn't, then I don't think we're ever going to scale this field. I don't think we're ever going to be able to provide services to all the people we need it without a telehealth option. I also think if we don't use telehealth, then we're going to get left behind by the rest of the medical community, because everyone else is using Teladoc, and mental health therapy is becoming more and more telehealth based and or AI based with certain new apps coming out. We have to stay with the times and figure out ways to make behavior analysis telehealth more standardized and more practiced. Most of the research with telehealth is all about an independent behaviorist doing telehealth without the RBT involved. We need more research about what's best practices supervision-wise for an RBT getting supervised by a telehealth behavior analyst. And I would love to see lots of surveys and social validity questions to caregivers and technicians and compare that to those same surveys for an in-person supervisor, because I think that's going to highlight the difference between the relationships. Now, the final thing I wanted to talk about is that independent behaviorist role. And I don't think this is like the correct term for it, but I've seen this term coined a couple different places, so I'm going to use it as well. The independent behaviorist is simply someone who provides behavior analytic services without the support of a behavior technician. So that means that rather than asking insurance or asking for private pay for 10 hours of RBT time and 2 hours of BCBA time, they're simply going to ask for the BCBA time. And some independent behaviorists only ask for that 2 hours, some ask for 10 hours, and they really do the full direct therapy with clients for 10 hours a week. It changes based on what the preference of the behavior analyst is. Now, what's important here is that these behavior analysts statistically probably weren't trained and experienced in being an independent behaviorist before. They probably served as registered behavior technicians, and they wanted to switch into the independents for a number of different reasons. Some of the things that I've heard are easier for scheduling, simpler for hiring, more straightforward for reimbursement, more freedom and flexibility without having to manage a staff. There's a lot of different advantages there, but it totally changes what your practice looks like. Like I said earlier in the episode, it changes what types of interventions and how you implement those interventions. If you only have 2 hours with a client, then how many hours are you going to spend in caregiver training for that client? Probably a heck of a lot. All of my time is, if I do independent behaviorist work, it's almost all spent in caregiver training. Maybe I do an hour with a client direct, but the other hour or half of my time tends to be in meetings with caregivers, trying to support and help them develop the behavioral strategies to put into place when I'm not there for the rest of the week. Now, I want everybody at this point, as we come to the end of the episode, to put their tinfoil cap on with me and just consider one thing that has really been bugging me ever since my friend, who's a mental health therapist, pointed it out to me. Now, she had served as a behavior technician for a long time and then got her master's in mental health and pointed out something really interesting. Tinfoil cap. Let's talk a little bit about this weird thing in our field that might need to be changed, but maybe we need to talk about it more. Mental health, SLP, OT, who implements the direct therapy to the clients? The master's level clinic. That's not the way it is in ABA. The master's level technician supervises the client. That makes sense, because in ABA, we're asking for 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 hours a week of therapy. And it wouldn't be scalable for a master's level practitioner to do all of that therapy time. But what if we didn't? What if we were able to find a way for master's level practitioners to practice and be effective at only 1, 2, 3 hours a week, similar to what our colleagues are doing in SLP and OT? What if we focused more on caregiver training and said, we're not the environment that's relevant for the context, they are? What would that look like? That's all. I just think it's worthwhile to consider. I think there's so much value in this independent behaviorist role, and I don't know if that's the future of our field. In fact, I can almost guarantee you it's not going to be the future of our field, but I don't know. It looks pretty tempting, and when you compare to the other professionals, I think it's worthwhile to consider. what is the secret sauce of SLP and OT that they can make impact with the learner in 30 minutes to an hour a week? I think it's time to get learning. So we can take your tinfoil hat off. No more conspiracy theories today. In fact, that is the end of the episode. Thank you for listening. Thank you for hanging out with me during this time, and I'll see you in the next one. So there you have it. That's the end of our podcast. It would mean the world to me if you commented or shared or however you're interacting with this content. Subscribe if you're on a podcast platform. If you are available, give a review to this podcast. Give it 5 stars if you love it. Give me feedback if not. I read every single one, and it does a ton to boost the visibility of content like this in the overall algorithm. If you want to continue engaging with the Behaviorist Book Club, the best place to go is the ABA Cafe Facebook group. You can find it just by typing in the ABA Cafe into your Facebook search bar. It is a group of research-minded practitioners engaging and collaborating together to become better behavior analysts through our application of practitioner-focused research. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next one.